My name is Judy Nadler. I'm a senior fellow in government ethics at the Markela Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University. And prior to taking that position, I served as the mayor of Santa Clara for two terms and was on the city council for many years as well. So I have an interesting perspective on the on this initiative process, because it was during my term in public office that some of the most dramatic and far-reaching initiatives were passed in the state of California, which had a dramatic impact on local government. So I want to thank the Commonwealth Club for inviting all of us to be here today to talk with you about the initiative process and the questions about judging from the discussion we had this morning, and in every other session I've been in, the initiative process has come up, so I know it will be something that will be very exciting. We do have the same process that we used earlier, so that you know, once we have the brief introduction of the subject and of the panelists, we will be hearing 10 minutes each from the panelists, and they'll also have an opportunity to do a little rebuttal if they need to. Then we are going to have participation and discussion here. We're actually going to take a vote, as we did this morning on sort of the straw ballot, and break into discussion groups, and then do the same 15 minutes for discussion groups, and then come back for reporting out. So that is the that's the order of the day. Briefly, I'm sure you all know about the initiative process, but I want to just let you know that actually it didn't start with Prop 13, although most people in other parts of the country seem to think that is how it all got started. You may know that back in 1911 that a special election was called by the governor, and that established the initiative process. And it is one that has grown considerably, and I mean grown not only in the number of and the scope of the issues that have come before the voters in California, but I often, about the time that my voter's pamphlet is going to arrive, am wondering, should I bring the wheelbarrow out to the mailbox? Because at 100-plus pages, it can be quite an awesome tome to try to go through all of the initiatives that come to the ballot. The direct initiative process, which allows the citizens, of course, to bypass the legislature and go to the public, and then the indirect, where you go before the legislature and the legislature places that on the ballot. There are a number of materials that I would recommend to you that the Commonwealth Club has put together, a reading list and various websites. The Secretary of State, of course, has an excellent website with information on this subject. There was also the Hertzberg study, which has an excellent summary of sort of the entire history if you're interested in learning more about that. But basically, it is important to know that you are making public policy when you go to vote on these initiatives, and it is a long-lasting, far-ranging, and we want to make sure that you understand that as we proceed. And you will be asked, actually, to vote after we hear the compelling arguments from our two panelists as to whether or not you think that there is need for reform in this process. So let me go quickly to our panelists. We are really honored today to have two outstanding gentlemen who are going to provide special perspectives on the initiative process. First, we have Tracy Western, who is the founder and CEO of the Center for Governmental Studies. Tracy is the vice chairman and CEO for CGS, which he founded in 1983. He has co-authored over two dozen reports and publications, and in fact, I believe one of them is quite a heavy tome that I picked up earlier today called Democracy by Initiative, Shaping California's Fourth Branch of Government. So based on that alone, we know that he is an incredible resource and someone with a great deal of knowledge on this subject. So we welcome Tracy. Our other panelist is Harvey Rosenfield, who is the founder and former president of the Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights. And that is a nonprofit consumer organization that deals with litigation research and advocacy, kind of under an umbrella. He was also the author of Prop 103, which some of you may recall was to restructure the insurance regulation in California. And I may actually have some questions for him about that because I'm still confused about how that all came about. And he's the founder of several nonprofit consumer advocacy groups that have been involved in healthcare issues and also energy deregulation. So he comes with a great deal of background and experience. So we will begin with Tracy.
Thank you. California's ballot initiative process, created in 1911, is now almost 100 years old. It will be in 2011, and boy, does it have problems. Critics argue initiatives are too long and complex, that voters lack the capacity to understand them, that they're too inflexible, that proponents can't amend them to correct errors before the ballot, and the legislature can't amend them after enactment, leaving the public stuck with, for decades, with ill-conceived measures. The legislature is excluded pretty much from the process with no incentive to negotiate since the proponents can't change the text anyway. The circulation process has become distorted. Collecting signatures from a supermarket is outmoded and expensive in the internet era, and that money distorts the process. It takes pretty much $1 million plus to qualify an initiative, but if you have that kind of money, you can probably qualify virtually anything. And on the other hand, tens of millions, hundreds of millions, are spent during the campaign, often on misleading TV ads, and sometimes the expenditures are lopsided, one-sided, leaving the public unsure what the truth really is. And voters lack information, finally. We figure, about 12 hours for the average voter to read the ballot pamphlet, and that's not including the text of the messages. That's just all the other materials. So on top of this, the United States Supreme Court has, ill-advisedly in my view, made reforms more difficult. First of all, it's declared that contribution limits on the amounts of money given to ballot measure committees are unconstitutional. It's also said that bans on paid signature gatherers are also unconstitutional, both as abridgments of free speech. So those two remedies look like they're off the table, right off the bat. And finally, the FCC, in an incredibly wrong-headed decision, in my view, repealed the fairness doctrine as it applies to ballot measure committees. Now, what that meant when it was in effect is that if one side has a lot of money to spend on paid ads, the broadcaster was required to present some time on the other side, so the public at least heard contrasting views. Not equal, but maybe a ratio of 1-3, 1-4. Now that's gone as well. So we can't limit the money, we can't limit the paid signature gatherers, and there's no longer a check in the broadcast industry to make sure voters hear both sides. Now, some argue the initiative process should be eliminated altogether, or at very least it ought to be harder to qualify them and they ought to be cut back. I actually disagree with that. And the California Commission on Campaign Financing, which Bob Stern and I both worked on, produced this report after 3 years of work. There are copies out on the table. We brought up a few if you want them. They're yours. Otherwise, write us. We'll send you one and charge you postage. So this is your chance to carry one away. We disagree, and for these reasons. First of all, the public overwhelmingly wants the initiative process. They support the initiative process over the legislative process, almost by a ratio of 2-1. Secondly, it's still needed. The legislature is often blocked by special interest money, term limits are having a problem. Redistricting is having a problem. Until the legislature becomes truly responsive, the ballot initiative process is there as a safety valve. That's what it was created for, and that's what it still is used for. In fact, the number one category of ballot measures passed over the last 70, 80 years have been government reform itself. It's very difficult for the legislature to reform itself. And that's where one of the key reasons for the initiative process. I can give you examples later. Now, since 1911, the U.S. Constitution has been amended 11 times, the California Constitution over 425 times, the ballot initiative process virtually none, once in 1966. So we think it's time that the ballot initiative process be modernized and brought into the 21st century and integrated in with the other structures of government. Now, what are some of the changes? Well, you're going to vote on these afterwards. I'm going to give you my list of 10, and if you're good, I'll throw in a bonus. First, a small one, but maybe useful. Initiatives ought to be capped at 5,000 words or even less. Why? Easier to read, shorter. They prevent advocates from paying money to buy their provisions into the measure, and it delegates more discretion to the legislature or to administrative bodies. So instead of trying to write every single measure, every single provision in high detail, pass them in broad brush, leave administration with some flexibility. Number two, require a legislative hearing once the measure qualifies for the ballot. That will expose the problems early to public view, and it will force the legislature to engage to a certain extent in the content of that measure instead of walking away and saying, hey, that's the initiative process. It has nothing to do with us. Number three, more controversial, more important. Allow the proponent to make minor amendments to the initiative after it qualifies for the ballot, but before it goes on the ballot. Why? To let them correct problems that they overlooked, errors, contradictions, omissions, so that we're not stuck with those errors and omissions if we vote for them. Now, the process of circulating a ballot measure is when everybody begins to focus on it, and that's when they begin to identify problems. Today, the proponent has to say, what problems? I don't see no problems. There aren't any problems. It's perfect. Knowing all along that they've missed stuff. This would allow them to fix deficiencies. But we would say you can only amend that initiative if it is consistent with the purposes and intent of the initiative. In other words, you can't throw it out and substitute a brand new initiative. These have to be minor corrective amendments. Bill authors can amend bills. We think proponents ought to be able to amend their bills as well. Four, and maybe the most important, we want to encourage the legislature to negotiate with a proponent of the initiative before the election to see if they can reach a compromise. If they can reach a compromise, the proponent can then pull it off the ballot and the legislature enacts legislation as a substitute. Maybe it's 80%, maybe it's 85%. If there's no compromise, the proponent still has full power to put it on the ballot after all. The proponent retains control over this. It just gives him an option of negotiating. Under California law today, once it qualifies, it has to go on the ballot, even though the proponent then thinks it's a mistake or thinks there's a better way of going about it. In other words, we want to give the proponent the flexibility to negotiate with the legislature to see if they can reach a compromise. California has the most rigid system of any state. This would catch mistakes, encourage legislative compromises, and allow the parties to fix errors. And it takes nothing away from the proponent. If they don't like the deal, put it on the ballot. Fifth, perhaps the most controversial, we would allow the legislature to make amendments to initiatives after enactment, but under certain restrictive conditions. First of all, they should only be allowed to do it by a supermajority, and we suggest 60%. Secondly, the amendments have to be consistent with the purposes and intent of the initiative. They can't repeal it. They can't substantially change it. They have to be corrective amendments. The Political Reform Act, which Bob Stern helped write many years ago, allowed the legislature to make amendments, and it's been amended 150 times without significant problems. Imagine if those 150 amendments had to all be circulated by initiative. It's completely unworkable. So we would build flexibility in before passage and after passage. Now, we might also say that if the legislature amends it and the proponent doesn't agree and they wants to challenge it, the proponent gets attorney's fees if they win. Or possibly even the proponent would have a veto over the amendment. That's a little more problematical. How do you find them 30 years later? But In other words, there ought to be some amendability built in. All other states allow some form of legislative amendment afterwards. And California is the only one that forces a second initiative to amend the first initiative. So we believe there ought to be some flexibility. Six, here's one that you may or may not like. Extend the circulation period from 150 days to 180 days. The problem now is that initiatives in California are too easy to qualify with money and too hard to qualify without money. If you have $1 million, $2 million, you can qualify anything. If you're a citizens group, a civic organization, if you rely on grassroots volunteers, it's extremely difficult to qualify in 150 days. We have virtually the shortest circulation period of any state. So by extending it by a month, you give a little more power to the citizens groups to qualify. You don't do anything for the big money groups. Seventh, I'd explore alternative measures of circulation, such as online circulation. Eighth, we need to improve voter information. How? We would disclose the top two contributors on the circulation, the signature when you circulate. We'd put that at the top. We'd disclose them on slate mailers, and we'd disclose them in TV ads. We'd ask the Secretary of State to allow proponents and opponents to videotape statements and put them on the Secretary of State's website. We would require all legislators to vote up or down, yes or no, on every measure that goes on the ballot and print their votes in the voter's pamphlet. And finally, we would ask the state to petition the FCC to reinstate the fairness doctrine for ballot measures. Ninth, let's try a high contribution limit on contributions of $100,000, say, and let's try another test in the United States Supreme Court. And finally, we would say no initiative can require a supermajority vote unless it itself passes by that same supermajority vote. That would put an end to 51% saying that in the future you can only amend it by a two-thirds vote, which we feel is highly undemocratic. And I have my bonus one, which I'll retain for the Q&A.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I neglected to acknowledge and thank Virginia, who is our timer. And she is going to not only keep our panelists on time, but also keep all of you on time when we get to the Q&A. But thank you very much, Tracy. And we'll wait with anticipation for that bonus number 10. So now, Harvey?
Okay, thank you. Thank you all for sticking it out till Friday afternoon. Well, as the author of Prop 103 and a proponent of measures to reform HMOs and stop the worst parts of electricity deregulation, I have always resisted proposals to, quote, reform the initiative process. For reasons I'll discuss in a few minutes, I've always kind of felt that they would not improve things, in fact, might make things worse. Today, however, I am in the position of reversing a 20-year record of being against initiative reforms, and I'll tell you why. I think Arnold Schwarzenegger has, in the last 6 months, done more to undermine and corrupt the initiative process than any other individual or event since it was first enacted in 1911. Next week, as you all know, Arnold Schwarzenegger is expected to announce a special election this November for a vote on his ballot propositions. Never before, as far as I can find in the history of California, has a sitting governor invoked his constitutional authority to call a special election when the only purpose was to vote on measures he himself has sponsored. There's absolutely no public urgency or other extenuating circumstance that would require the taxpayers of California have to pay $80 million for Mr. Schwarzenegger's his personal election in November. Rather, it's clear that Mr. Schwarzenegger is calling this election for his own political and partisan purposes. There's nothing in these initiatives that is necessary to happen now that can't be done in November 2006. Why is Mr. Schwarzenegger doing this now? Well, number one, it has allowed him to surreptitiously collect $40 million in donations, largely from special interests, that he couldn't do under state rules that prohibit donations to legislators or to elected officials of over $25,000 per person. Number two, By holding the special election this year, Schwarzenegger is trying to evade a rule that prohibits any candidate for public office from appearing in a commercial in which for an election in which he is on the ballot. And, of course, the special election avoids that problem. He's not on this ballot. He'd be on the November ballot or on the primary ballot in 2006. Now, I'd like to, Virginia, if you wouldn't mind, would you pull the envelope away from that screen? Here are two frames from Mr. Schwarzenegger's latest campaign commercial. If you'll notice, not only has he broken new ground by evading state campaign disclosure requirements, if you'll notice that there's a bottle of Arrowhead in the top frame and a Pepsi in the bottom frame. Now, anybody who works in the political environment knows that no campaign commercial ever visualizes a product because they would be instantly sued by the maker of the product and didn't want to be associated with it. Well, it turns out that Mr. Schwarzenegger's one of his major donors is the Nestle company, which owns, guess who? Arrowhead, clearly visible in the top. Pepsi, Diet Pepsi, down below. The rules Mr. Schwarzenegger is evading are intended to prevent exactly the abuses that he's engaging in here. He is utilizing the initiative process to fund a high-visibility campaign designed to promote his partisan political need to have his candidacy available to the voters and also to promote the interests of his special interest donors. This is exactly what the initiative process was designed to prevent. The initiative process was supposed to be all about voters using it as a tool when elected officials in the government in Sacramento refused to take action. Instead, Mr. Schwarzenegger has turned this whole thing on its face, and he has made a mockery of this tool of democracy by using the process to feather his own nest and to advance the interests of the powerful corporations whose donations he has solicited. Exactly the opposite of what it's intended to do. Now, governors are supposed to govern. That's the operative language of the word governor. If Mr. Schwarzenegger wants to sponsor ballot propositions, what he ought to do is become a private citizen that he can do all he wants. So I have two proposals for you. Four months ago, I would have been here saying, for reasons I'm about to express, do not do anything to the initiative process. But now I have two proposals for you to add to the list. Number one, except when there's a state of emergency declared by the governor or when the legislature passes a resolution by a two-thirds vote, I don't think the governor should call a special election at all. They're too expensive. Number two, I don't think the governor should be allowed to sponsor or raise money for initiatives at all. I don't think any governor in California should be allowed to raise money or to solicit money for ballot measures. We elect the governor to govern. That means working with the legislative branch on the passage of legislation and then enforcing those laws. People want to do ballot measures, they can do what I do or any of you do as private citizens. Now, let me spend a couple of minutes talking about Tracy's proposals. I have a great deal of respect for Tracy and for the Center for Governmental Studies. I've known these people for a very long time. They're really great, smart, thoughtful people. But having said that, with all due respect, Tracy, I think you're completely wrong on your major proposals. Let me explain why very quickly. Number one, let's talk about allowing the proponent to negotiate with the legislature to change a ballot measure after he's collected signatures, he or she has collected signatures. And also the idea of making minor amendments and requiring the legislature to have hearings. Well, the legislature had its chance. That is the operative theory behind the initiative process. When we did in 1988, or when what Howard Jarvis did in 1978, went to the legislature, tried to get them to pass insurance reform, they did not do it. That is when the legislature has its chance. After that, the voters take over. And now let me explain to you what's very dangerous about letting the legislature get involved in this after the fact. My premise is that once the people put enough signatures on the ballot to get it on the petition to get it on the ballot, that petition belongs to those people who signed it, not to the proponent, not to me or anybody else. Can you imagine the idea, the mischief that is possible if a proponent is allowed to negotiate changes to the petition that the voters put their signature to before that thing goes on the ballot? I mean, There's a guy in Sacramento who runs an environmental organization who has sold the right to put provisions in his initiatives to special interests. He's got the utility companies to fund measures. He's got chemical polluters to fund parts of his measure. In other words, the danger of allowing the legislature a role in this process after the fact is to disempower the people who signed that specific petition to get it on the ballot. They want that reform, and hand it all over to the people in Sacramento and some poor proponent who either may or may not have enough integrity to maintain that his or her position against the possibility that somebody's going to put money into his nonprofit organization, or maybe the legislature is going to pass some other bill. Under that proposal, initiatives could be used simply to raise money in a form of blackmail. Allowing legislative amendments, I'm sorry, I'm going fast. We could talk about this more of this afterwards. Allowing amendments to the legislature, well, to the initiative, we did that in Proposition 103. As the Constitution allows us to do, it can be amended by a two-thirds vote of the legislature as long as it, quote, furthers the purposes of Proposition 103. Well, guess what? Guess what happened up there in Sacramento? The insurance industry spent a whole bunch of money on a guy named Don Parada, who's the president pro tem of the state senate right now. They gave him a bunch of money. He sponsored an amendment to Proposition 103 2 years ago, which repealed a part of Proposition 103. Didn't further the purpose. Of course, the legislature, quote, found that it furthered the purpose to repeal a part of Prop 103. Passed overwhelmingly because the insurance company and their ally Don Parada handed out so much money up there that every legislator basically got a piece of it. And then the thing passed, and you know what? We've had to sue to court. It's taken us 2.5 years. That law is still in effect. The Superior Court in Los Angeles did determine that it was unconstitutional as an invalid amendment to Proposition 103, but now it's gone to the Court of Appeal. We're going to win that case. It's going to take us 4 years. We're going to get attorney's fees because the law allows that. But in the meantime, the invalid amendment to Prop 103 is in effect. So there's another example of why an idea of allowing the lawmakers to amend these things is something that you really got to be careful of. The Constitution allows it now. If I were to redo it, I'm not sure I would write Prop 103 to permit legislative amendments, because that was the third time that they did it. The other two times, we both got them invalidated by the courts. I'm out of time. I apologize for rushing through it, but I hope I provoked you a little bit. Thanks.
Well, you have my blood pressure's up. But we did agree that the two of you could have a little point-counterpoint after your initial presentation, which I think will further stimulate the types of questions that will come from our audience. So I'll give you each a minute.
Well,
or so.
This may surprise Harvey, but I agree with him on one point. I do think the special election is ridiculous. The governor's doing that because he likes to be in the spotlight. That's what the governor does. He likes to be out campaigning in front of the people, and it pulls publicity around him. It also allows him to raise a lot of money. But the truth is, if there's a special election in November, it's only 7 months away from the election in June. It could all be decided in June, saving the state a cost of $80 million. Besides, John Van de Kamp lost for governor a number of years ago, and he put three initiatives together and ran on a platform of supporting the initiatives, and it split his money. This lets the governor not split his money. He spends this year raising millions and millions of dollars to promote his initiatives, and then he runs next year raising millions and millions of dollars to promote his campaign for governor. So it's basically two bites of the apple, and it's unnecessary. I disagree with everything else, however, but it just shows I'm not arbitrary in my disagreement.
Thank you, Trish.
First of all, on negotiating with the legislature, that this somehow betrays the people who signed it, I'm sure most of you have signed initiatives. How many of you have read the full text of the initiative before you signed it? Three? Yeah. Most people don't. They sign based on a caption or an understanding of a thrust of the measure. How many legislators vote on legislation after reading the entire bill? Virtually none. The proponent is a proxy for a certain message. The problem is if you don't let them amend before it goes on the ballot, you lock in all the mistakes they've made. In the legislative process, there are hearings in both houses, there's negotiation between the houses, negotiation between the governors, and they still get it wrong 25% of the time. But if you don't allow amendment before or after, you are doomed to locking in terrible mistakes. Prop 13 has had to be amended by initiative 13 times. The Political Reform Act, 150 times. Do you want all of those on the ballot? That's an impossible way to run the sixth largest economy in the world. We have to build flexibility into the process. If we don't, we're frustrated to be painted into a corner in terms of our actions with no way to get out.
Okay, Harvey?
No, let's
you're set to go. Okay. So I'm expecting that we'll have quite a few questions, and I hope that they will be questions. We are going to be really, really precise on the timekeeping. And so 30 seconds is 30 seconds. And at 15 seconds, you'll get the reminder that you have only 15 seconds left. So choose your words wisely.
Bob Stern, Center for Governmental Studies. Harvey, Governor Reagan called a special election in 1973 for his initiative, and I think Pete Wilson did in 1993 also, so it's not unprecedented. The question I have for you is, under Tracy's proposal, the proponent would have the power to negotiate with the legislature, and you're saying the proponent is flaky? Aren't you a proponent? I mean, didn't you represent your people?
I think it's a huge mistake to I think the proponent acts as a representative of the people who signed the petition. And it would be a huge mistake to give the proponent the authority to negotiate or even be subject to the pressure in Sacramento, including subjecting the initiative to an attack by the people who obviously weren't able or prepared to support it as legislation when it was before them. It just gives the legislature a forum to do mischief. I think it poses a huge threat of fraud or extortion or blackmail by special interests that towards the proponent or towards other members of the legislature in a devious attempt to undermine a process that they left when they refused to take action as legislators.
If I could just add, remember, if the proponent amends it, it still goes on the ballot and it still gets voted on. Most people, the press, the public, never focus on it until it gets on the ballot. So that's when the attention comes out. So it's not as though you're slipping something by the public. They haven't even started to think about it. They'll think about it when it's on the ballot, and at least let's get it corrected of errors.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, I agree with the analysis that you've proposed in terms of some of the motivations for the special election, but I'd like to suggest that there are some others that we should be thinking about some policy responses to. One, separate and apart, perhaps the governor is doing this, perhaps not. Isn't there an element of election shopping going on? Isn't there a feeling that a special election of this sort will have a lower turnout? You will get the advocates on both sides. The vast majority will vote with their feet and not pay attention, and that therefore it's possible to put through measures which might not survive at another time. Is there something we can do about this? Isn't there also a factor of voter fatigue that comes in? And is it possible to say that we should have standardized election days here in California statewide and locally?
Thank you.
I would just say vote for my proposal to limit a special election to an emergency or to a resolution requiring one by the legislature rather than permitting an individual in the governor's office to use his authority in this way, and leave it to the voters. The voters are pretty smart. My prediction is a lot of these measures are going to go down just because of voter fatigue in November.
Very, very briefly, voter fatigue and voter drop-off on the ballot, it's interesting. If you look at the statistics, ballot measures often get more votes than do major candidates like congressmen, state senators. The truth is that people understand ballot measures more than they understand the people they're voting for. They know what they're getting with a ballot measure. It's all written down. With an elected official, they don't know what he's done, and they don't know what he's going to do. So in an interesting way, voters are often more interested in voting on initiatives than many candidates on the ballot.
So are you predicting a higher turnout for
No two bites of the apple.
I wanted to first just applaud the last answer, because it is true that it's much tougher to figure out two blow-dried candidates and what they're going to do than something that's written in black and white. I wanted to address the idea of moving the petition period from 150 days to 180 days. Around the country, I'm with a group called Citizens in Charge. Our goal is to expand this process to other states. Around the country, there's restriction after restriction to stop the big, wealthy special interests. And it seems like every single one of them makes it more expensive to do initiatives. I wondered, instead of going to 180 days, why not go to a year-long period, which would allow even more grassroots groups to qualify initiatives? It seems that I applaud the move from 150 to 180 days. It seems weak. Why not go further?
It was a balance. It was trying to look at public acceptance. It didn't seem too much. You're right. Some states have 2 years. Some have unlimited. California used to be a lot more until the legislature shrunk it down. The basic point here is this. If the initiative is supposed to be the people's legislature, then you can't make it so difficult and expensive that only wealthy interests can get it on the ballot. Extending the period will do nothing for the big wealthy interests. They'll get it on anyway. But you may give the civic groups a little more chance to do it as to whether it's 180 days, a little longer. At some point, you have to judge what will the public accept. But I don't have a problem with longer ballot measure periods. I think it would actually revitalize civic circulation instead of just paid circulation.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Trace. Didn't it used to be 2 years, and then the legislature threw it back to 150 days?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. The legislature cut it back. It used to be 2 years. No, you're right.
Yes.
I have one sort of argument and one thing that really is a genuine question. The genuine question is there's a lot of variation within California in the requirements for local initiatives. Do you think it's too easy in some places or too hard in other places? I live in Oakland, which has half the population of San Francisco, and it takes twice as many signatures to qualify an initiative in Oakland as it does to qualify one in San Francisco. The thing that's more of an argument is for Harvey, don't we already have negotiations with proponents over whether to withdraw an initiative where they've collected signatures but not turned them in?
You know, Prop 103, when we were collecting the signatures for Prop 103, the insurance industry and the trial lawyers got together and made a deal in Sacramento that if we failed to collect the signatures because we were doing it the grassroots way, that they would withdraw their initiatives, which were counter-initiatives attacking our initiative. They actually changed the law in Sacramento to allow them to stand down if they were able to block us from getting on the ballot. Just another reason why the legislature should not be involved in the initiative process once that process is invoked by the people.
Now, on the question of how many signatures it takes, he was indicating...
Well, I think that is a problem. L.A. County, very difficult to get something on the ballot. I'm not sure what to do about it. You could standardize it. You could say every city and county has to have the same proportional criteria as in the state. I haven't really thought that through yet. I'm not sure what that would mean in some counties and some cities. But you're right. It's very difficult in some jurisdictions locally. It's almost impossible because the requirements are so high.
Thank you. Yes.
What about sunsets for initiatives?
Well, then you might just get them to do it all over again. I mean, if you're worried about the number of initiatives, then that might double them every 5 years. On the other hand, there's some sense to that because no matter how much sense something makes, 5, 10, 20, 30, 40 years later, obviously there are problems with it, and it's very rigid to change. You could sunset it. You could discourage constitutional amendments by requiring a higher vote count, for instance, leaving them in the statutory initiative phase so that they're more easily amendable. You could give the legislature, I think the ability to let the legislature modify it so long as it's consistent with purpose and intent might be a better way than forcing a second vote all over again. But we've looked at that. We think amendability is a little better, but it's not. That's a possibility. It just means more elections, more money, more confusion.
So Proposition 103 has blocked $23 billion in auto insurance rate increases alone since 1988, according to a Washington, D.C. report. The word is now that the insurance industry has gone to Governor Schwarzenegger and the Republican Party and offered $200 million if they will sponsor a measure in the legislature to put on the ballot to repeal Prop 103. If an initiative that's been passed isn't working, there are plenty of people, plenty of ways to get the thing back on the ballot to challenge it, to repeal it by the people, the same electorate that put it into law. And that's an adequate way of protecting whatever concerns anybody has about whether an initiative, whether it's Prop 103 or Prop 13, has outlived its usefulness.
Could you please briefly discuss the initiative process or lack thereof in other states? What has worked for them, what hasn't worked, as well as I would like to hear your comments on a national initiative process. Was the feasibility of that taking place? Thank you.
Yeah. 24 states in the District of Columbia have the initiative process, so it's about half the states. However, those states reach 70% of the American population. So 70% of the people have an initiative. Some of them are very restrictive, very hard to pass, very high signatures, can't get it through the legislature. Massachusetts has a lot of trouble. Sometimes initiatives have to be approved by the legislature. So in general, I think the initiative process is a good one in that it counters a legislature that's blocked for other reasons. I'll give you an example very quickly. In 1988, legislators had tried to get an increase in the cigarette tax passed for years, and we had the lowest cigarette tax in the nation. They finally went the initiative process, got it on the ballot, a five cent per pack increase, and the cigarette industry put $23 million against it, and there was virtually no money spent in favor of it. It passed. Now, what does that say about the legislative process? Legislators couldn't even get it out of committee because of lobbying and special interest contributions. So as long as we have a representative system that's blocked with money, we need a safety valve, and I think that's a valuable one. I would support a national initiative. I would make it advisory at first. And I might even say there's a national referendum on one or two questions a year, and the Congress has to give a formal response. But I don't know that I would make it binding yet.
I would answer your question this way. Like democracy itself, the initiative process is not perfect. And most of the things that are problems with the initiative process, like the overwhelming impact of money by corporate interests or special interests, is true of the democracy itself. And I'll tell you the one reform that needs to be done that I would support, that it's hardly ever discussed, is that changing the Supreme Court decision that Tracy referred to a few minutes ago. The one that held that for purposes of the First Amendment freedom of speech, a corporation is the same as a human being. I think we need to change the First Amendment, however that has to happen, to say that corporations are not the same as people, because the Supreme Court has said that corporations can spend as much money as they have, the same way that people can spend as much money as they have in the political process. And until that is done, nothing that we've identified today that's wrong with the initiative process can be fixed, or democracy for that matter.
Let me just put a quick gloss on that. In the 1990 elections, we remember looking at the data, 67% of the money raised by all ballot measure committees came in contribution amounts of $100,000 or more. 37% of all the money raised by all the measures came in contribution amounts of $1 million or more. So this, to say that a contribution limit abridges freedom of speech ignores the fact that those heavy contributions are drowning out the speech of everyone else. So I think we need a relook at it.
Thank you.
Paul Turner again with the Greenlining Institute. This issue of initiative reform really resonates in the minority communities. You only have to look at Prop 187, Prop 209 to increase the ire there. Do you think, given that the initiative process dilutes minority political participation in California, do you think that is a violation of the Voting Rights Act, and is that something that can be used as a cause for reform of the initiative process in California? Then I would say on the issue of allowing drafting of an initiative after it qualifies, sometimes you can defeat an initiative based on its poor wordedness and the way it's drafted. That's how we were able to defeat Prop 54. So I'd probably be against drafts after it's qualified, changing it.
Well, actually, you raise a very, very difficult question, and I'm troubled by that probably more than anything else. In the legislative process, minority interests, whether racial, cultural, social, whatever, can bargain. They can say, look, I'll give you my vote on this one, I'll give you my vote on this one, but when it comes to something I really care about, you give me your vote. And minorities can then block regressive legislation by pulling in chits. The initiative process is a simple up or down vote on anything. There's no vote trading. So I do think the initiative process exposes minority interests to more danger than the legislative process. And I'm frankly not sure. I don't think it violates the Civil Rights Act, but I'm not sure what to do about that other than, remember, amendability afterwards is a way of fixing problems. And when without going to another initiative or without going to the courts. Now, again, the courts are there to protect minorities against oppressive initiatives as well as oppressive legislation. I mean, this is a problem with legislation, too. So we do have the courts. We do have follow-up initiatives, but it is a troubling aspect of the initiative process.
Okay, we have just 5 minutes for Q&A, so I'll let you all know that in advance. Next.
I think the initiative process is out of control. The mandates it creates to hamstring the legislature, and I say the legislature should be the people who are informed and should know what they're voting about. And then my question is, if Hiram Johnson were alive today, what do you think about, he would think about what's going on?
Well, I think he would call for the initiative process even more than before. If he were alive today and we hadn't had an initiative process up to 2005, he'd be out there pounding the hustings and calling for one. Now, he might draft it differently. The Internet would be involved. There are other forms of structure. But I think clearly he would be calling it. Looking at a legislature that's blocked with special interest money, term limits, redistricting, lobbying money, he would say, my God, we need it more than ever.
I think he'd be appalled at what he saw, but I don't think he'd support any of Tracy's proposals.
Quick question. I just wanted to know why we couldn't have the legislature, either at the city level or the county level or the state level, take a bite at that initiative as introduced and qualified and voted up or down without amendment. And if it passes, then it's taken off the ballot, and it seems like it would simplify the ballot for the voter.
That's a variation of what we proposed. But the problem, so yes, but the problem is that the initiative process has induced the legislature to back away. They simply say, it's an initiative. It's nothing to do with us. Don't look at me. Don't blame me. It's up to them. It's up to the public. And we've hired these people. We elect them to be a specialist in legislation, and then they deal themselves out of the process. So we've got to figure out a way of getting them back in. In the legislative process, you have hearings first, and then you vote. In the initiative processes, you vote, and then everybody starts having a hearing about what went wrong. It's backwards.
I just want to say, when we sponsored legislation which would have reversed parts of the electricity deregulation debacle 2 years before the energy crisis that was caused by deregulation, Gray Davis and Dan Lundgren, his opposing candidate for governor in 1998, both opposed Proposition 9. And they had the utility companies organize, and Enron, the energy industry, organize the entire establishment, political establishment in the state to oppose Proposition 9. If you give the legislature a forum to meddle with an initiative, negotiate with a proponent, or do anything, we are just asking for trouble. We are giving the legislature a chance to do even more damage than they do as individuals when they don't take any action on an issue of public importance.
Hi, Ned Bigglesworth with TheRestOfUs.org. I just want to say I'm not surprised, but I take heart in the fact that our starting point for this discussion is both of you guys saying the initiative process is important, and let's figure out how to make it better. Tracy, on the point about allowing amendments after people have collected signatures, I think my contracts professor would probably be a little uncomfortable with that. And I wonder if instead of allowing for amendments on the backside, if your point, which is a good one, I think, doesn't include if the better way to solve that isn't to encourage people to discuss initiatives on the front side during the drafting process and to make that a more public process. Thanks.
It's not a bad idea if we can figure out how to do it. It's very difficult to actually mechanically do. I don't think it is a contract between a person who signs it. They never read it. What they often say is, well, let's get it on the ballot and then I'll think about it. So I don't think it's changing the rules. I think it gives the proponent should be treated as a proxy for the interests represented. And if they themselves have detected a mistake, I think the people who have signed it would want that mistake fixed.
Okay, this is the last question. We'll make it quick.
Yes, it will be. Jack Knox floated a number of the ideas that you're proposing maybe 20 years ago. And I was wondering if you were aware of that. And it just sort of disappeared into thin air. So I was wondering whether
I don't recall them now. We may have looked at them when we prepared this book, but I'd be happy to see them if you could send them to us. I would like to see them. You know, can I make one last point?
Mm-hmm.
Scientific American had a very interesting article, and there's been some new research on this, and that's the integrity of group decision-making. How good is it? And the people have run experiments, and what they found is very interesting and counterintuitive. It is that large groups of average people often, most often, come to a better conclusion than experts. And they've run this. I'll give you an example. They put a lot of balls in a big glass bowl, and they said, guess how many are in that? The average of all of the people's guesses was the number one result. No individual got closer than the group did. Remember when a Russian submarine was lost? They had about 60 experts estimate, given drift and temperature and all the rest, what the location was. None of those experts came closer than the average guess of all of the experts. In other words, group decision-making, for reasons that aren't terribly clear, is often better than the decision of experts. So we need to remember that the initiative process is one of the largest groups you can think of. And there are plenty of initiatives that I disagree with, and I'm sure those that you disagree with, but it's rare that you will find one that collectively the public in California would say, oh, my God, we made a mistake. Prop 13, you may agree or disagree. You put it on the ballot, it's going to get it approved again. So the public, at least, is very satisfied with the process and believes that on balance, with a few exceptions, most of the results are ones they would vote for over again. So don't be too discouraged about this process. It is democracy in action. As Harvey said, every process is flawed. The legislature spends 25% of its time correcting mistakes made in the last legislative session. So at the very least, we can't expect the initiative process to be perfect, but it does give the public a very important voice that otherwise it would not have.